Welcome to the Reach the Stars podcast, a collection of conversations with cool people who do cool things. Brought to you by Papercraft Miracles. Each week, we'll bring you inspiring stories of persistence, passion, and purpose. With your host, Jonna Willoughby-Lore.
Welcome to the Reach the Stars podcast. I'm your host, Jonna Willoughby-Lore, and I am so pumped this week. My guest is one of my favorite people on earth. His name is Joe Donahue, and he has this magical singing voice, but his personality is just so special. And you know, sometimes when you meet people in the world and they're just like inherently good, like, you know, that's like, wow, that's just a really good person. Like, Joe Donahue is a really good person. And I am very excited to share him with you today. So welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing better now that I get to talk to you. Yay.
Good. That's good to hear.
So Joe is a singer and a musician and all around theater geek. And I'm sure many other things that he's going to tell you all about. Wow, I'm just very happy that he's here today. Interpretive dancer for y'all who are watching the video. You should check it out.
We're working on it.
Getting some Vogue over there. Strike a pose.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Awesome. So do you want to tell everybody a little bit more about you and where you come from?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm from like the South towns of Buffalo, but I've lived in Buffalo on the west side of Buffalo for about 18 years now. I grew up playing music at church. I grew up idolizing, Sheryl Crow and, Tori Amos. And I mean, just kind of a really wide mix of mostly female artists, but, that's kind of where my musical background comes from. And then I wanted to learn guitar because of Jewel. So I also had I've always had a deep interest in theater. So I music direct for various professional theaters in Buffalo and elsewhere. And I act as well. So sometimes I'm an actor. Sometimes I'm playing piano while it's being wheeled about the stage. It depends. But my life has been a performer. And I'm a third generation performer as well. I'm the third, Joseph Aloysius Donahue the third. But I'm also a third generation performer. My grandparents were all performers.
That is so cool.
I think that sums it up. I don't know.
So when you were growing up, was it just like music around you all the time at your house?
Yes. Well, you know, there wasn't a lot of music around me, but there were instruments around me. So there was opportunity for music. And maybe for everyone else, there was music around because I was the one playing it. But there were a lot of instruments around, and I think that has a lot to do with why I was able to, play music because it was available to me.
Yeah, I hear that too.
It's not available to so many people sometimes. Who has a real piano in their house anymore? Which just like breaks my heart.
I do.
Do you? Do you?
Yeah, all right, I do. Good. You'll have to come play it once I'm officially 2 weeks post-vaccinated. Play our baby grand piano in our giant foyer.
Oh my gosh, I would love to. That'd be cool. Yeah. Are you going to have it soon before I play it?
No, but if you could do that.
<Yeah, no. laughs>
It's definitely not in tune, but it's old school. It used to be a player.
That's even better. Then we can like rock over it. You can.
It still has the mechanisms, but it doesn't like play the player part right. But you can play it like a regular piano. But
oh, it's a player piano.
Yeah, really old one.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with these old pianos in Buffalo. There's so many from like schools. A lot of schools have a lot of old pianos, and they don't know what to do with them. And there's some really good companies in Buffalo that. And people just that have altruistic interest in making this better because there's so many old pianos that need repair, more serious repair than kind of seems. You know, these pianos are from the 1890s up to the 1930s, and they need repair. And there's so many schools that have like a ton of pianos. It's actually something I'm very passionate about. So
maybe
a little weird geeking out about it.
Yeah, but
these schools collect these pianos, and over time they deteriorate. And then what happens sometimes is they'll hire someone that will put new parts on old parts instead of, you know, repair it in the first place and bring new life into the piano. The pianos are living beings. They're made of wood and trees.
Yeah, our piano could use some new life, that's for sure. Neither one of us really knows how to play it all that well, but we were like, we had a tenant who couldn't pay the whole security deposit, but he was like, I got a storage full of pianos if you want one in exchange for a security deposit. So he paid us, instead of paying us rent, he gave us a piano.
I got a piano once, and it was I thought it was going to be like my fixer upper, like my like antique car that I was going to like fix up and make gorgeous. But it was a Lennon. I got a Lennon, and I stored it at my mom's house. And 2 years into it, I had to just get rid of it, which was sad. But
okay. So we could talk about pianos all day, but I want to know more about you. So. Having obviously, like, you started playing instruments when you were really little, like 3, 4 probably.
3, yeah. I went to community music school in Buffalo when I was 3, because my mom had, I was singing Whitney Houston in a band. My dad is very, very talented musician, my biological dad, and he and also my grandfather on my mom's side, so I kind of had music coming on both sides of the family. And my mom recognized, like, you know, talent early on, and she really wanted to do something about it. So she registered me at the community music school on Elmwood in Buffalo, which is currently not in the best financial position, but that's where I went. And I was too young at the time. I was 3, and they said, come back when your hands are a little bigger. But then I had a good scholarship to go there for a while, and Ed Kramer taught me piano. Melissa Stewart taught me the Suzuki method on piano, and that was very much by ear, by rote. You memorize things, but you also are supposed to read things as well. Mm-hmm. So there was some situation. I mentioned her name. I don't know if I... There was a situation with that, and they kind of like reverted me back to it. They're like, well, you were memorizing too much. Like, I was playing Mozart and all kind of, I mean, Mozart's my rock, but I was playing really complicated pieces at a young age, but it was only because I was memorizing what my teacher was doing. Mm-hmm. I wasn't reading it. I wasn't really like learning it. I was just kind of memorizing it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of people think that for a musician might make you a phony because you're just kind of like memorizing stuff. But I'm someone who can prove them wrong because I music direct for professional theaters. I've done, you know, both sides. I play violin for pit orchestras just as a violin player. I've played lead roles in shows and you know, you kind of have to like put on different hats and just do it. If you're a performer, you're a true performer and a true musician, which I always think of myself as a musician first, then it's all gonna happen somehow.
Totally. And like, I have seen it when I watch you play, is that you're always in the pocket of the song. Like, there, it doesn't matter if you were reading it or not. Like, you are in the rhythm of it, and you don't have to like separate yourself out to read it specifically as notes on the page. You know, it's like, you can tell that, you know, that this note goes there because that's where it's supposed to go. Because I'm a similar way when I play music too. Is it like,
for sure you are.
If you've ever seen my book, Oh Trumpet Notes, when I play with the vegans, it has like handwritten like musical notes in it, but it doesn't make any sense musically. It's just for me. It's like, oh, that part. It's like, you do play these notes, but as far as like what the rhythm of how it's played or anything like that, how long you hold any of the notes, none of that is written on there. So nobody else could play it.
That's you.
I looked at it, but I can play it.
That interpretation goes like, you know, there's passengers and drivers, like people are listening to us as performers and we need them just as much as they need us for the people that, you know, have the true interest. And I just think that's such a great relationship between listener and creator. When it comes to artistic like expression.
Exactly. So how old were you the first time you performed on a stage?
So my dad was an organist. He used to play at the Riviera. Is an organist. He's not dead. And he used to play pipe organ, like the multi-rank pipe organs. Mm-hmm. And for any of your listeners that are familiar with the Riviera Theater, he used to play, the organ used to rise up and he could like with his feet control all the different instruments that it was connected to. I mean, it was crazy. It was the 90s and it was kind of like really crazy for the time that an organist could do all these things. So the first time, and he would draw, you know, the theater would be filled up. I mean, the Riv would be filled up. So I think I was like 9 and he had me put a fake beard on because he's got a beard like me. And he had me like rise up on the organ for the second act, like as act two opens. Here I am dressed like my dad, but I'm playing like a Mozart tune. And then I turn around and it's like, that was the first time really, especially in front of a big crowd. But the first time I panicked, I'd rather tell you about that. The first time I panicked, I was at the Riv playing one of my dad's concerts because we became kind of a novelty. My sister played flute and I played piano and we used to play Aladdin and The Little Mermaid and Phantom of the Opera, Think of Me, piano and flute. It was pretty and it was like bonding time for my sister. She's my only Polly, all my family is my family, but biologically she's my only full-blooded sister. Mm-hmm. And we used to have this like great musical connection and we still do, but she lives in Vegas and whatever. But we used to play at the Riv for my dad and I played this song and I just like freaked out, dude. I freaked out and I played it. It was so fast. And it was my first time in front of like 1,000 people alone. Like now I wasn't with my sister, you know, my backup, you know, ride or die. I was just alone. And so my dad like played it off and he was cool about it. He like he said something. Oh, that was me. I turned the thing off accidentally during that. He said something to the audience that made it better, but it was very terrifying, you know, like to feel really helpless and like just frozen. Mm-hmm. On stage. Have you ever felt that?
It's weird because like I started performing as a poet, not a musician. And
in front of you.
Yeah, it's almost always, it's just you. But I started reading my poems for like adult audiences when I was 12, because my mom made me start going to these open mics. And when you're the 12-year-old kid, it's like reading a poem to a room full of adults, like they clap for you. I'm like, it's kind of built into the poetry scene that like, if you choke reading a poem on stage, people are like, you got this. You know what I mean? Like the audience is very supportive of it. Like just start over. It's fine. You know, like
it's beautiful, but you're thinking in your head, if you're a perfectionist, then you're
thinking like, it totally does, but it is
up, nice that, I like, to like, how do I fix this? And
I think freezing as a poet is slightly has a different type of reaction to the audience than if you freeze as a musician. You know what I mean? I don't know if that's It's just like the audience hear poetry is like, it's okay. You got emotional. It's fine. I'm emotional. Start over, you know? But sometimes if someone is up as like the entertainer, as the musician, that people can view it differently. And then they'll be like, you know, they sucked on the stage tonight, you know, whatever. I think people are quicker to judge somebody playing music than to judge somebody reading poetry. What do you think? I don't know.
I have a school of performance that I kind of go by. I don't have a method per se. I didn't go to musical theater school. Don't let them see you sweat. Like, you got to make sure that people are entertained. And when people are watching you sweat, it's not entertaining. So if you mess up, how fast can you recover? That's all it is.
Yeah, the show must go on, right?
So as a musician, to answer your question more fully, my left hand can keep going. You know, I can vamp. If I mess up what I'm saying, because, you know, I have to be DJ sometime, ladies and gentlemen, here comes the bride. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes I have to be all these different things. And so I always know that I can, like, piano is my go-to, I'm saying. As a musician, there's something like almost a disconnect, like vocally I might think like, oh, my brain is like trying to think of what I'm supposed to be saying or lyrics or something or whatever, or I messed up. I can vamp it out, you know. I can take a little moment and gather myself, or I can say, oh, what the fuck was that, you know. I can do that because as a kind of cabaret piano player, my setting allows that sort of, like you were saying about poetry, it sort of allows that. But I have background music, so that's the difference.
Yeah, I used to play piano when I was a kid, but I was never good at paying attention to any of the actual lessons, and I similarly, like, I figured out how to play a couple of songs. I memorized those songs and I like to play those songs. But I took music theory in high school, and by the end of the first semester of that, it kind of like clicked, and I was like, oh, music is now this language in my head. It makes sense the way that it's supposed to go together. And when you're readily using that, it continues to be a language that you can just like communicate in that way, you know? But I stopped doing music theory when I graduated high school, and it very quickly just like went away. But I did take a piano class when I was in college, just like a beginner piano class. And while it took like everything I could do to actually play anything at all with my left hand without messing it up, like, it's really hard for me to do the same thing with, or to do different things with both hands at the same time.
Yeah.
Like that. I don't know if it's just like the different halves of my brain do not want to communicate properly.
It's different. I think it's age too. One of my professors at Ferronia was very adamant that it was that once, and I don't agree with this, but he thought that he prescribed to the idea that once you're past 14, if you didn't get into music before 14, you don't really have a shot. It's not, you can try as hard as you can. Mm-hmm. You can work hard, but it's never going to be innate. It's never going to be like, you know, like, it's just, it's expression.
It's not going to establish itself as a language in your head the same.
Yeah, and seriously, I disagree with this professor, but I also respect the opinion because I am someone that learned very young, so I really can't say.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I teach piano, mm-hmm, and guitar, violin, voice. But that's not my passion. Otherwise, I would have finished music school, you know.
I don't know. My dad played guitar, and my mom sang in the church, and she was always listening to music, and she's the main reason why I know like any bands. Because she used to play the who's this game in the car all the time. And she would like, who sings this? Who sings this? And she would always say, like, you can always tell it's the Rolling Stones because the guy sounds like he's like trying to eat a bag of cats or something. Like she would think of like all these like goofy things to remind you of like the way that people's guitar sounds or, you know, how their voice sounds and stuff like that. And so I do that with my kid in the car, and my kid is like stellar at it. It's amazing. He's amazing. Like he's not even, you know, by the time he was 2.5, he could
recognize. He got it on both sides.
Just like, yeah, like he could just recognize so many songs. I'm like, who sings this? Like we were in the car a couple weeks ago. He's almost 6. And this song comes on the radio and it's the Chili Peppers covering Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground. And I was like, hey, Vern, who sings this? Okay. And he's like, well, like, I'll give you a hint. I was like, I'll give you a hint. It's a cover song. So the original is very old and this is a new version. And he's like, okay, well, because this is Red Hot Chili Peppers. I was like, yes, it is. And then he's just like, but this song, I was like, the song is called Higher Ground. And he's like, yeah, that's Stevie Wonder. I was like, yes, right on, child. Like, he's like, amazing. And stuff like that.
So, it's pretty amazing.
Oh, now I got to fix my backdrop. Oh,
that's so much more impressive than like memorizing the presidents of the United States or something. Mm-hmm. Like much rather.
There's so many songs. And like, he's been teaching my youngest too. So now we have, you know, the Alexa thing in the kitchen. So they can ask it. They can ask the robot to play their songs. Listening. And the stuff that my kids ask to play is hysterical. Like yesterday, my youngest goes, Alexa, play Pretty Fly for a White Guy on Spotify. He's like 3 years old. Oh my God.
And they have no idea, like that song. We're old, Jonna, whatever. But you know what? We just have to teach the younger generation where that stuff came. Why that was funny at the time and like context has always been important when you're learning about writers and people who wrote something. Why did they write it and what was going on at the time and maybe go to politics and say like what was happening when Steinbeck wrote novel or whoever or Frost or what, Bukowski comes to mind, of course, because I'm a college kid at heart. But like, what was going on at the time, like that made this person feel that way, or how did they grow up? Which really, honestly, disconnects me from poets a lot of the time, because a lot of the affluent white poets that came out of Europe and they I can't relate very much to them. And so their work becomes very inaccessible. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. There is this kind of like subset of poetry that is just really heady and really hard to understand what's going on in it, and you have to like sit there for days with all of the thesauruses and like dissect the potential meaning behind all of this heady stuff. And like, I would really, oh, now my kids are gonna come in here.
Are you doing a podcast or something?
Yes. All right, so after a little interlude of children, we're back, and I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about your experience during the pandemic as an immunocompromised musician.
Yeah, I had a kidney transplant in 2000. Well, I actually had two kidney transplants. I was lucky enough to have two of my sisters donate kidneys to me. So as blessed and lucky as I am to have received those gifts of life, it has left me in a compromised position with my immune system. So COVID is hard to navigate. I guess, you know, we hear the words first line a lot, the people on the first lines. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not a first line musician. You know, I'm not going to be one of the first musicians that are out there playing. So for me, COVID really doesn't end professionally until 2023, you know, I mean, it depends. I mean, I'm vaccinated, but you know, how long does that last? And everyone, you know, that's a whole other can of worms. So, you know, for me personally, I just avoid, you know, crowds, and I can't put myself in that atmosphere. And I've had to turn down a lot of work because of that. But I don't regret it. Awesome. But I don't regret it.
Yeah.
Because I'm just healthy. I can't play music if I'm not alive.
Exactly. So one of the things that due to being at home during COVID and wanting to still play music, there is a Facebook group for fans of Tori Amos. And Joe will occasionally go in there and play like these amazing concerts as if he was channeling
the guy. We got reconnected.
I mean, I was like really having a bummer day, and I saw Joe post that he was going to go play some Tori songs live in this Facebook group. So I went in there, and it was just like this magical experience of being there with this Tori Amos jukebox who could literally play like almost any Tori song on demand. I was like, oh, this is so what I need, you know, because sometimes, you know, and then you would play songs that I had totally forgotten about, and I'd be like, oh my God, and that one, you know, like I've been a Tori Amos fan for a long time. I started listening to her when I was maybe 13, maybe 14, like freshman year of high school, and really got into listening to her music a lot. And
yeah, but freshman year, I'd say.
I had one of her quotes as my senior quote.
Me too.
Oh my God.
Do you remember yours?
Yeah, totally. What's yours?
Mine was, she had said something about how you like feed off of people, and like you can feed off of whoever you, I'm paraphrasing, of course, you can feed off of this energy only for so long. Like when you're with someone, you can only feed off them for so long. And in the end, you're just a vampire.
Mm-hmm. Mine was like, it must be worth losing if it is worth something.
That's a good one. I feel like I was trying to be a little more pretentious.
I put two quotes together. I had her quote, and then I had a Soul Coughing quote after that.
All right.
So it was, it must be worth losing if it is worth something. And you can stand on the arms of the Williamsburg Bridge crying, hey man, well, this is Babylon. So that was my senior quote. It's like those two quotes together as one.
Some from Tallulah and some from
Soul Coughing.
Soul Coughing.
From True Dreams of Wichita.
Yeah, the Tori Amos group, I just thought was interesting because I was like, you know, there must be other people. I know there were like Tori files in the 90s. Like, remember going on the early internet and seeing being part of the Dent and a lot of like I guess it's like the Reddit of the time. Mm-hmm. Of just people being obsessed with Tori Amos, and we call ourselves Tori Files and Ears with Feet, and we were obsessed with just like collecting B-sides from whatever country you could get them from. eBay was a new thing, and you could collect B-sides. She kind of came along at a point. I don't know. She saved a lot of people.
She did.
Not only through her organization, Rain, but through her music and her organization does beautiful work as well, of course.
So what's your favorite Tori song? Today.
It's like Madonna.
It changes every day.
It changes every day. Today, I know you know every desperado sharpshooter in the West. You say I can leave behind the men, all those who call themselves the good guys in this. Who take it, take, so are you with me or not? She said, this time, decide. This one. Mommy thinks sweet sangria. That's the one.
Ooh,
that's
cool.
How I have to remember songs. I have to sing it until I come to the title of the song. Sweet sangria is my favorite song today, apparently. But my all time favorites, you know, just like Madonna, I have a new favorite every day, but my all time favorites would be, Cloud on My Tongue. Marianne.
Oh, for sure. That is up there on my top songs too.
Beauty Queen, Horses. I woke up to a coma too when I was 16. I got sick with bacterial meningitis. I was in a coma for a few weeks, and my mom put earbuds. My mom happened to be in a coma as well when she was 17, and she was able to hear people around her. This is kind of weird, but she knew that I could hear people around me, and I could at times. At times, when you're in a coma, at times you're put into a sleep state. Sometimes you wake up from it. Sometimes they realize that you're waking up from it, so they put you back in the sleep state. Well, my mom put these earbuds on and put on Boys for Pele and put it in my ear, and Beauty Queen, and it was way too loud. Oh my gosh, it was way too loud. But it was in a period that I was waking up from the coma, and I woke, I swear to Christ, like the only thing I could hear, I couldn't move my body, at all. The only thing I could do was listen. I couldn't adjust the volume, but I didn't want to. It just like the sound of the Leslie coming on, and I just remember everything so, so precisely. And I feel like it kept me alive. I mean, just like my mom's voice, along with that experience with that album, those are the things that I was able to grab onto from my conscious mind as a 16-year-old. But as a human, I was able to remember those things and latch onto those real moments, because I had some really fucked up dreams. I was on a lot of fentanyl when I was in a coma. The Tori song, and my mom would sing to me sometimes some of the church songs that we played a lot, and those would really ground me. So they had, you know, just to start to explain, like, obviously it's a can of worms, but yeah, she's affected me very deeply in life. So as she has with many people, and I imagine she just wants to live her own life. You know, I don't feel like I have to talk to her when, you know, I would love to talk to her, of course, but I'm glad that her songs are there for people.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Crazy resource that was never, I never thought. I don't know. She's an enigma.
I was just thinking about this yesterday, that there's like, it took me a long time to realize that there were people who listen to music and don't listen to the words, and like aren't emotionally affected by music like that. And I didn't know that everyone wasn't like that until like fairly recently. I would say like I was already an adult before I realized that like not everybody did that. And I'm pretty sure obviously that you are the same type of person as me, that like you could hear a song and like either the words or the music together, and you'd be like crying, totally crying to music. There's people who cry to music and people who don't.
When they come together, when they like perfectly intersect, it's like, ooh.
Oh my God. The first time I ever heard Stairway to Heaven, I was in the backseat of my mom's car. I was 5. And while the song is playing, I'm like, my mom was a heavy smoker, so like she would smoke while we were driving around in the car. And so there was always a lot of smoke in the back seat. So I like to like lay down on the seat. This is so 80s. But I would like lay down on the seat. So I was like underneath the top layer of the smoke in the car. And
in the Beauville.
Yeah. In like the 1990 Cutlass or whatever, 85 Cutlass, Oldsmobile or some crap. But I'm in the back seat, and the song is like halfway through, and it's in the middle of like the big guitar solo that's like 3/4 of the way through the song that like reaches that crazy I know exactly, you know what I'm talking about, that climax part in the song. And my mom looks in the mirror, and I'm like bawling in the back seat, like right at the like the climax part of the song, and she's like, why are you crying? I'm like, this song is so moving. And she's like, ah, oh, shit. Like, my 5-year-old is bawling to Led Zeppelin.
An artist.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's interesting because my husband, he loves music too, but he listens to music and I would say probably 90% of the time, he doesn't notice the words at all. Yeah. And he only hears the music.
Of more like him. Music.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll never say, but poetry is very important to me in my own music. I like to be expressive lyrically. I think, you know, I love Fiona Apple and Tori Amos and Alanis Morissette, people that are very clever with their wording and how they say things and how they use alliteration and, you know, different tools mm-hmm. that we have as writers. I tend to, you know, I'm not going to really listen to the lyrics of a song sometimes if I'm not into the music.
It's funny.
I hear the music first.
I always hear the words first.
Really?
Yeah.
You're more of a poet than I am.
Yeah, I'm always like listening for, you know, how the words come together and what and the meaning that comes with them. And then does that meaning go with what the music is? And then, you know, if it does, you're like, oh my God, it's the best. But yeah,
right. I mean, when you can create a story or find a reason if they're talking about what they're talking about.
Exactly. It's like sometimes
and meetings upon meetings to end up hearing something on the radio.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes there's, you know, a song that'll come along then. It just has this really interesting rhythm to the way that the words come out. And so that's, you know, like I'll hear the musicality of that, but I'll always be listening for like, what are they actually saying? And I remember on a road trip to DC and I was like 10 years old and I had one of my first tapes I ever bought was Document by REM. And I brought that with me and I continuously listened to It's the End of the World as We Know It over and over and over again, the whole way to and from this trip so that I could figure out what he was saying and write it down so I could sing along to that song. Yeah. And it's like, I desperately wanted to know what he was saying and how to say that like that. So I'm pretty sure that like that trip, that song, that album is part of the reason why I'm a rapper now, even though that song and that band are not rappers, but like his way of
familiar with the cadence that you can flow in mm-hmm. you're going to inherently get creative with it and put your own words in there. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, like that kind of punchy slam poetry over music style. I definitely, right. I got a lot of that from old school hip hop. My older brother was big on hip hop and I listened to a lot of Vanilla Ice when I was really little too. I had this little silver boombox that had like one big speaker and a tape player and a radio. And I totally got, I got out my Sharpie, my little fine point Sharpie, and I decorated the whole front of my boombox and it said like Vanilla Ice on it. I was like 8. And I used to like hold it up on my shoulder and like rock out to Vanilla Ice. It's this little white girl. So ridiculous. But yeah, my brother would listen to that.
On your shoulder.
Yeah, he was listening to like KRS-One and Cypress Hill and like he had such this crazy eclectic taste of music and I had no CDs and I was always like stealing his CDs and he was always getting mad at me. So I definitely had like a lot of musical influence from my mom and then my brother, but man,
I stole CDs from my siblings too. I stole Guns N' Roses CDs from my brother and I stole Cranberry CDs from my sister. So I don't know. I think that kind of says it.
I don't think I ever actually stole any of his CDs, but I would go into his room and listen to them on his boombox in his room.
Oh, I would take them, but my sister Becky would be like, she'd like say to the whole family, she's like, my Cranberry CD has gone missing. And I wonder if now that I'm talking about it, if it's just going to magically appear in my room tomorrow. It's me that took it. I'm sorry. But I told her about that. Don't worry.
I didn't even have a CD player of my own until...
I was the last to get one.
Eighth grade, sure. Maybe? I had a tape player and I had my little boombox thing, but I didn't have any way to play CDs on my own until...
That was like our
version of... It was like eighth grade.
And it's like when you're 13, you get a cell phone.
I know. It's so weird to think that like the world, like my kids have Alexa to play whatever they want, whenever they want. And I was like, oh, as a high school kid, I remember going to the park in the middle of the night to like hang out with my friends because we were cool, like, quote unquote cool. And we would bring like one of those tape players that you would record somebody for an interview. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so I have one.
We'd bring
that play Madonna tapes on it in the shower.
We would bring that to the park. Exactly. And like, that would be the way that we listen to music. It's like a group of four or five people hanging out on one of those little tape players. And now
I got yelled at in Days Park last summer. This guy just sat there strong arming us. And the funny thing was like my cassette player batteries were dying. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the same cassette player, like the one that you record on. And
yeah, they had like the orange button in it. And when you held them both down together, it would start recording like an old
the mini cassette, are you saying?
No, like a regular size cassette tape, but it, like the whole thing was this big. It has speaker on one side, speaker on the other. Yeah.
I had that and I was playing it in the park and it was after 10 and Days Park closes at 10. I don't understand. But we were not being loud because the cassette player batteries were so dead that it wasn't playing loud enough anyway for him to be complaining about whatever. I digress.
Oh my goodness. All right, Joe, I can talk to you all day, but I only have like 20 minutes, but at the end of all of the episodes of this show, I ask all the guests the same 5 questions because I think it's really interesting to hear how different people answer the same questions in different ways. And don't panic. Like, all right, it's 5 question time. Okay. Question number 1, tell me about an experience that shaped who you are today. Like one of those moments where after that one moment, everything was totally different.
When I got bacterial meningitis as a 16-year-old, it was a temporary illness and it just affected everything. It was then and now, and it was half my life ago, but still.
That's so wild. Do you want to tell any more about it?
Just that, you know, it affects how you think. I mean, it affected how I thought about school when I went back to school at 17. It's not about the grades. It was more about staying alive. And unfortunately, I was more in survival mode than I needed to be. But, you know, through therapy and through writing and through art and creativity, I've been able to express those things, and that's been incredibly therapeutic. So even though that has been such a defining thing in my life, it's I would never take it back.
How long were you sick when you had it?
I was in the hospital for 2 months. They expected me to be in for over a year. I was in for about 2.5 months. And once in a while, my parents was like sneaking out and taking me to a movie or something. Once in a great while. I snuck out once and got a hot dog from the movies. You know, one when they were still at Bryant.
Before they caught on fire.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Remember Coffee And?
Yes.
Do you?
Yes. Coffee And is the reason that I know Alex.
Really?
I ran the Bloodthirsty Vegans at all. Like that's where
I played Pop It on Preach at Coffee And. And then like 2 days later it burned down. That was the first time I ever played anything in public, like in Buffalo, anywhere really. Or in Buffalo, like in the city.
That's crazy. Yeah, I used to go to the open mics there all the time. And Coffee And their open mic that they had before it burned to the ground is the reason, well, one of the main impetus reasons why Alex is a rapper at all.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Because like
We found it.
Do you know that guy Lazarus?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, Lazarus opened up for us. He's very, very talented. He's awesome.
So me and Lazarus and there was a couple other people who were Amy Upham, and a couple other people who would go and like do performance style poetry at that open mic. And Alex kept sitting in the crowd like, man, I want to do that. I have all these things I wrote, but I'm afraid to go up on the stage. And we like inspired him.
Do it now.
He eventually did go do it and then realized like, oh my God, that's my whole, very much at home there now. It's weird too. But yes, I definitely remember Coffee and game changer for me.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Okay, all right, before we get too distracted. Question number two. When you feel defeated or overcome, what do you tell yourself to keep going?
I'm Joe fucking Donahue. I don't know. My friend in high school was like, I don't know, I'm from like Lakeview, okay? Like Hamburg, like Lakeview. And we were just like, a different breed. I don't know. We just like everyone looked out for each other a lot. There was a lot of like, I guess what you'd call like shade. There was so much like everyone. There were so many fighters. Everyone felt like they had to fight. Everyone was like fighting all the time. So, you know, a lot of neighborhoods are like that. You grow up in a kind of thing like that. Wait, what was the question again?
About how you're Joe fucking Donahue.
That's what I tell myself. So my friend Travis, at a show of ours, he was just so supportive. Like he was so supportive, you know, being gay. All these friends like came out and support, like they were all really supportive and they would come to my shows, you know, like they were our fan base. To start, and they were like supporting their home team, and it was like, you know, I don't know. There was this show at Good Bar and on Elmwood, and you just hear Travis screaming, or maybe it was at Mohawk Place. I think it was at Mohawk Place. You hear my friend screaming in the background. He goes, "Joe fucking Donahue." And also, I have to say as a caveat, there's a little. Lady Gaga says that to herself when I think someone asked her like a similar question, and she's like, "What do you do when you feel like you're defeated? Like you got to get up and say like I'm Lady fucking Gaga. Like I have to get up and do this shit. Like this isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always about you. Like you have to keep doing it even if you're not feeling it sometimes. Emily Dickinson style.
Exactly." Oh my goodness. Okay. Question number three. Tell me about a way you overcame a failure or a mistake and what you learned from it.
A failure or mistake and what I learned from it. I learned that I played a song way too fast. When I get nervous, I play songs fast. And I have learned through recordings that I need to slow down. and also try to keep like, one of my things, or I dare say specialties, is being able to switch keys on the fly. So I can, you know, start a song in D and switch to E flat and then switch to E and go to F and a sharp and blah, blah, blah. Find whatever key is right for my voice. So sometimes I'll start a song in the wrong key and I can overcome it by thinking in my head while I'm playing and thinking on the fly, what key do I have to be in to sound good, to sound better?
I know that's totally a skill that I do not have at all. I cannot like
my dad. My dad
song, like it sounds on the radio. I can't sing along to it.
Like I need it lowered a key, and then people call you Judy Garland, and they're like, "Oh, okay, Judy. she wants it lowered to keys." That's where I come in. That's where I'm like, okay, like that's my specialty. Okay.
Oh, I love it. Does anybody ever give you shit about being a guy that sings mostly songs that are written by women?
Yeah. My whole life.
That sucks because you are really good at it.
I don't care. I just don't care. I seriously don't. That's like the one. I'm very self-conscious. I mean, I'm very self-aware and very self-conscious. But I'm not, but when it comes to that, I just don't fucking care. I've never cared. They've always been like, you sound like a girl. or, oh, dude, I thought a girl was singing. I thought I was looking for the chick. You know, we used to play straight bar, like all kinds of bars and everything. I was looking for the chick, bro. I looked over, I saw you. I said, what the fuck? It's a dude. But you got to be... Or, and they're impressed. So it's like their way of complimenting you. It's just like sort of backhanded.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, I don't really like gay dudes, but you're pretty cool. It's like, oh, cool. Thanks. Cool.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
But I always like that too. Being the one that stands out.
Yeah. I like surprising people. I know that I certainly like coming out on the stage looking like me and then busting out with like crazy rap songs. People are like, wait, what? How are you the same person that just did that? What? So I love that. I love surprising people. There was one time I was playing a show at Nietzsche's, and it was like maybe the summer after I came back from college. So I was like kind of new on the scene, but I'd gone to enough open mics to get a show of playing solo at Nietzsche's. And I was on the flyer, and I come in, I go to the bar, I'm like, got my glass of water because I don't really drink. And I overhear these two guys looking at the flyer, and they're like, oh, yeah, that MC Vendetta. I hear that dude is hard. And so I like leaned right over their shoulder. I'm like, that dude is so hard.
So, you know, yeah, that dude
no,
is
I totally
so
just played along with it. I was like, yeah, that dude so hard. Wait till you see that. Wait till you see him. Wait till you see him. And then like, I go up on the stage and I come up and they're like, yo, it's MC Vendetta. And then these two guys are like, what? And then
I
bust out with my first song and they were like, no way. And then they were like, you know, it's funny because, you know, dudes in the audience, whenever I perform, are either like really all about it and they think it's super awesome and they want to like tell everybody they know about it. Yeah.
Or honestly, likewise.
Or they're like pissed off that they can't do what I do. And then they get all like,
sorry. Everyone's made for it. If it were easy, everyone would do it. It's not easy. That's what I mean about my school of performing is you're not supposed to see the performer sweat. You want to see like cool, like you want to see someone that's got it together and someone that makes it look easy, even though it's not easy or everyone would do it.
Exactly.
It's not.
There's parts of performing that's easy for me, but it's this.
Well, it comes natural to you then.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, it just doesn't.
It's weird. It's like the only part where I'm uncomfortable with performing is right before it starts. Like, I'm just like, hurry up.
Oh yeah. Get all attitude.
I'm an actor
through and through, and I don't mean to be, I'm like too old for it, but I still like, yeah, before performances, I get freaked out. And
it's not like I get nervous, but it's just like, I have so much energy that's like building up and I'm like, it's all like a racehorse behind the gate, you know, just like chomping at the bit, ready to go. So that, you know, as soon as I get so much adrenaline that usually it takes me like the first song for that adrenaline to like chill out a little bit. So I'm not like, oh, in people's faces when I first come out.
Yeah.
I can't wait to be playing a show on a stage again. We're going to play the Lawn Disco this summer for anyone that's local.
Yeah.
We are going to play the Lawn Disco, which is outdoor show.
Yay.
Nice. I'll go to that.
Yeah. We're going to do two outdoor gigs this summer, hopefully.
Oh, good. Good.
I miss my Bloodthirsty Vegans. If anyone out there has never heard of my band and you're having a crap day and you want to be uplifted and feel better and dance the dances of freedom, we make music to dance it out to. And you can find us at bloodthirstyvegans.bandcamp.com. Anyway, a little advertisement for my band in the middle of my show. Okay.
Absolutely.
Question number four.
Okay.
This is the most disorganized five questions ever. Question number four.
I know. Sorry. It's me.
No, it's me.
It's my head.
All right. What one trait or habit is most responsible for keeping you on track?
Smoking weed. Sorry. Marijuana.
Why? I love that when people have good marijuana stories.
It just, I mean, you know, we're without going too far into it, we're taught to think a certain way, to act a certain way, to accept certain things. And weed like takes you out of that. It can like really open up your brain, much the way LSD is being studied, and how drugs that were once thought of as so taboo are now being used medically and very effectively at that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I do not shame anyone who takes antidepressants. I think they're very helpful for some people. They can be temporary drugs. They can be long-term drugs. They like can be very helpful, but I personally don't want to take them. I was like put on them as a 13-year-old, you know. I wasn't trying to, I want to figure it out some other way. And I know there's people that disagree with that. And I, that's why I want to say, I respect the people that want to take medicine for depression, for anxiety, for the things that they have. But I need to talk it out. Therapy and through creativity. And once again, I forgot the question.
You cracked me up. Okay. I just think it's funny that it's like, what keeps you on track? Smoking weed. I forgot the question.
No, I forgot the question. It keeps me on track in a way that keeps me on track artistically. It keeps me like focused that there's an alternative way to think. There's not just the programmed way that we're all taught to think, or act in a 9-to-5 kind of way. It keeps me on track for me. That I guess that's what I'm trying to answer is like, what is on track for me?
Mm-hmm.
On track is that I'm paying attention to my creative side, and weed helps me pay attention to my creative side.
True. Agreed. I mean, obviously I'm a big proponent of marijuana. I'm, you know, probably would have been dead a long time ago without it.
Me too.
Yeah. I injured my back when I was 16 and I couldn't eat food. It would take me like 45 minutes to an hour to eat one Oreo cookie. Felt like I did crunches 24 hours a day for like 2 years, and it was awful. And I weighed like 80 pounds at the lowest out of it, cause I just like literally couldn't eat. But smoking pot as a teenager saved my life. Yeah. Like it was the only thing that allowed me to relax enough to eat enough food so I wouldn't die. And it was crazy. So I will never, you know, not only that, but I've been, you know, used it to treat migraines for most of my adult life. Now I actually get to legally use it to treat migraines. Thanks, New York State, for giving my card and then legalizing it. Yay. So I just think that in times like these, where obviously it's becoming more mainstream that like marijuana is not that big a deal, I also think that there's going to be stigma out there surrounding it for a really long time. And I think the more that we have positive stories about how, you know, using marijuana in different ways can help treat a wide range of ailments, and can cause a lot of really amazing good things to happen in the world. So anyway, that was my little weed commercial.
Absolutely.
Oh my goodness. Question number 5, what is the best piece of advice you've ever gotten, and what advice would you give other people?
The best piece of advice I've ever gotten is don't have a backup plan. And what I would tell other people is don't have a backup plan. I mean, you have to commit yourself to it. Every part of yourself. Otherwise you're going to cop out and go to your backup plan. I don't know. This is someone who did Instacart today. So, like, you know, you got to do what you have to do to make sure that your art is produced and put out there and thoughtfully introduced to the world. That's your responsibility as an artist. So my advice would be take it fucking seriously, because no one else will. that's just the thing. That's just the thing that we know as artists, that we're not taken seriously. We're not taken as seriously because the arts are always cut. The arts are always less favored over sports or whatever. And yet we consume so much art as a society, as a country. We consume art nonstop. I mean, look at COVID in 2020. All we did was watch TV. I mean, all I did was watch Parks and Rec. Like, I hate that show. Okay. Like, I watched every episode of it. We consume art nonstop. And yet we, you know, how it, you see, it makes no sense to me. So yeah. The thing is, like, more people need to take it seriously. So if there's advice that I could give, the best advice that I got is don't have a backup plan, because it made me believe in my talent and it makes me not stop. I'm not going to stop. I'm 36. And I use Madonna as a reference. You wouldn't tell Madonna at 36 to stop. Or this or any of it, you know, you got to keep moving. Keep it moving. Keep it important. There's a lot to say out there. There's a lot to say. People need to be changed. And we, as artists, have an opportunity to do that. To change people. A responsibility.
Joe, that was like the most beautiful 2 minutes of soliloquy on the show, I think. It was like so nice. I can't wait to like grab that little snippet and put that out all by itself. Oh, it's lovely. All right. I have another meeting I have to go to, but I really want you to sing a song. Will you sing us a song?
Yeah. So my artist name is Joseph Aloysius, Aloysius on Facebook, Joseph Aloysius. And this is a song, this is part of a song that I released on there. It's called Fussy Fussy.
So fussy, fussy for someone who craves simple things in life. Oh, I'm too focused on me while I watch you fall asleep. And so fussy, fussy for someone who craves simple things in life. Oh, I'm to focus on me while I watch you while you sleep.
Just a little bit.
Aww, a little teaser. A little teaser.
It's on Spotify, it's on Apple Music.
Awesome. So I will have links to all that and to where you can find Joe in the show notes. And I hope that you will all go and listen to his music, because he didn't have any instruments here today. I'm going to have him back and bring the instruments, because this guy, the way he communicates through piano.
Hey, pretty soon we can just hang out in person.
I know, so soon. But man, you got to go find the Tori Amos group on Facebook. I'll put a link to that too. And you can.
Oh my God, please do. Oh my God.
I will. And you can probably scroll back in there and then you can watch and listen to Joe playing Tori Amos songs like a jukebox. It's amazing. But go listen to his music and buy his music and make it possible for this amazing, talented, beautiful, just the sweetest individual. Make it possible for him to keep paying his bills until it can be safe enough for him to go back and play out in public for all y'all. Cause he's just a dynamite performer and worth every single penny.
And listen to the Bloodthirsty Vegans.
Yes. One of these days I will recruit Joe to come and practice with us and play with us. And then you can be a Bloodthirsty Vegan for life.
And I don't know how long your editor takes, but I'm playing on Wednesday.
It's going to come out after Wednesday, but if you have any other gigs, I'll let you know when it's coming out, and those will be posted in the show notes too. Cool. All right. I have to run to another meeting, but thank you so much for being on my show today and for putting up the craziness while my kid had a meltdown in the middle of the show. Hashtag pandemic life.
All right. I had a costume change. It's fine.
I know. All right. Thanks for hanging with us on the Reach the Stars podcast. I have been your host, John Willoughby-Lore. My guest, Joe Donahue. Thanks so much for being here. If you love the show, make sure you rate it on iTunes. Give us a little thumbs up and subscribe on YouTube so you can watch all the videos. And hopefully very soon we'll be coming out with like subtitles and little synopsis. And we're working on our accessibility for the show. So if there's things that you think are really cool, if you know somebody that's cool and you want to nominate them to get interviewed on this show, you can email me at reachthestarspodcast@gmail.com. All right, y'all. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. Bye.
A single interaction has the power to change your life forever. This is a place for the stories of those moments. Stories of pursuing dreams, overcoming tragedy and failure, of coming back to life after so much of what feels like dying, of continuing on with only a vision as a map. This is the place where those moments live on. Come sit by the fire, look up at the stars, and be forever changed too.
Thank you for being with us on the Reach the Stars podcast. Our theme music is generously provided by Byrocratic. You can find him on Bandcamp.com. Thank you to all of our current patrons, guests, and everyone else who helps make this dream a reality. We are so proud to be building this amazing community with all of you. If you love this podcast, please consider sharing with a friend, leaving a review on iTunes, and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/reachthestars. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel to see the videos of these conversations. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, do something cool and tell us about it.